Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 373, Monday, August 3rd, 2020.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, KMO here, and what I have for you today is the first three chapters, really the first introduction and two chapters, of Donald J. Putin on American exceptionalism. It's not you, it's just America being America. So I had Donald J. Putin here on the podcast pretty recently, and I mentioned the possibility of recording an audiobook version of his book, and he said yes, so I have started on that, and Donald J. Putin has graciously agreed to let me provide this material to you, the Sea Realm Vault subscribers, in advance, which really helps me kill multiple birds with, you know, fewer projectiles, as it were. Which is to say, I get to create Sea Realm Vault content while I'm creating the audiobook. So that's going to come at the end of the podcast. The podcast will be, you know, the non-audiobook portion of the podcast will be shorter than usual by quite a bit, I think. And I'm going to start off by reading some feedback from folks who are responding to my conversation with First of Incelmatics. And first up in the comments, and apologies for my failing to see this comment when it was first posted. All comments have to be approved by me before they go up on the website, which is kind of laughable because the website is constructed such that nobody who isn't already a Vault subscriber can really see these things or post, you know, to those areas of the website. And it is such a small group of people who actually uses that that opportunity, you know, to leave permanent comments to these episodes. And one of those folks who, for years now, has left excellent comments is Leet Minion. And in response to the episode 562, Broken Monogamy, Leet Minion writes, "The red pill is such a powerful and interesting meme because it encapsulates the black pill idea. I think more so than other ideas about secret truth. Most ideas about secret wealth are more straightforwardly, this will help you be happy and successful. Taking the red pill, on the other hand, well, the truth will set you free, even give you superpowers eventually, maybe, but the immediate effect is replacing your pervasive sense of unease in your otherwise relatively normal life with a terrifying nightmare struggle. It's a powerful analogy, often an apt one. But that framing also gives it a bit of extra power in coalescing communities, where the norm is that community members start unhappy and get unhappier. I was a lonely young man. I didn't have a serious relationship until I was 25, and I never had much luck with online dating. That was in the OkCupid days. OkCupid was all right, but at least they tried to get people to break the ice with other people they might match well with. Tried to get a little more depth in their first impressions, and tried to provide some additional elements of sociability and fun. Starting with those little shareable personality quizzes. Memes, in the old LJ parlance. And I had forgotten about that. Leet Minion is somebody that I was communicating with on LiveJournal years before I started the Sea Realm podcast. And LiveJournal for me is my, you know, my first impression of social media, and I don't think that any social media platform has done a better job than LiveJournal did back in the day, although you kind of did need to know some HTML. Anyway, Leet Minion continues. From what I saw, paid dating sites were generally much worse. Still, I only got a few dates through the site and its crazy blind date spinoff, and never a second. OkCupid got gradually worse, and my hope faded that they'd find big creative solutions that make the landscape better. That was pre-Tinder. So I was never on Tinder. My assumption is I would have done much worse on Tinder. Still, as much as I think the rise of online dating is part of an alarming trend, where the in-person social sphere has become much more impoverished in all sorts of ways, I think there is some element of catastrophizing in your reaction to that in this episode. And I'll just pause here and say that Leet Minion is employing some skillful means here in that I have publicly rejected, or at least, you know, publicly stated that I will be on guard against catastrophizing in my own podcast output. Leet Minion continues, "Women on Tinder have an easy time finding hookups, but that doesn't mean that dating five Brad Pitts is the new standard. People can be mean, but instant escalation from, I don't really want to talk right now, to accusations of sexual harassment seems like the sort of thing most people would find rather extreme. Is that really what you're seeing in your own life? And here I asked Leet Minion if he was asking me or if he was asking first, because I'm kind of divorced from this whole scene right now. So my own personal experience, you know, with regard to online dating couldn't be more impoverished. Leet Minion continues, there's some element of the incel crowd that seems to be really in favor of shame or other means of social control in order to promote monogamy more strongly. Even when I was frustrated by dating, that never appealed to me. And I think there is some irony in going from taking the red pill to wanting a society where people are forced into conformity, either living in happy ignorance or experiencing a pervasive but inexplicable sense that there's something wrong with the world. To put it another way, a problem that has no name. I do wish there was more good help for men who are having trouble meeting people or building the sorts of relationships they want. I don't think doomerish thinking really helps with that. Though, of course, the doomer rejoinder would be that nothing helps. Back when I was dating, a lot of the useful advice along those lines came from the adjacent online community of pickup artists. Though it was a bit like picking coins out of the muck sometimes, there was plenty of misogyny, misanthropy, and generally taking a very transactional approach to relationships in that community, too. And the advice was tailored to a specific scene. Still, there was a lot of stuff there about specific ways people could improve their social skills. How many aspects of attractiveness are mutable, and it's counterproductive to get hung up on things you can't change. How thinking someone else will fix all your problems gets in the way of fixing some of your own problems. How despair and desperation block social connection. Plus, there were definitely some clear examples of how, objectively, being a huge dork is not necessarily an obstacle. All right, well, there's a lot going on in there. The pickup artist scene. I had a glancing encounter with its precursor back in the 1990s. It was the NLP speed seduction scene. And yeah, definitely picking coins out of the muck there. And a very transactional framing of the whole male-female interaction was definitely on display in that scene. So it's not one that I would direct anybody to, because there's a lot of failure modes for that that sort of interaction, and the punishments for failure, you know, for bad flirting, as it were, are much harsher today than they were back in the 90s. Now, on to catastrophism and doomerism. Colin, over at the TV station, with whom I make videos from time to time, not many since the pandemic started, but you know who I'm talking about. Colin describes himself as a doomer, although not in the peak oil sense. He doesn't think that the demise of industrial civilization is perpetually, you know, within a few minutes of happening. In fact, as far as I can tell, he doesn't give, you know, those sorts of dark prognostications any credence whatsoever. But he still describes himself as a doomer, and by that, I think he means he's a nihilist, or maybe an extreme pessimist. But there is a lot of overlap, as first of Incel Maddox described. A lot of the folks in his community know who I am because they are attracted to my older material, where I was talking about how, you know, industrial civilization definitely has some serious systematic weaknesses that could bring it down at any time. And, you know, for a lot of folks in that community, that's good news, because, you know, if everything goes to hell at once, it punishes the fortunate along with the unfortunate. And I'm familiar with that mindset from my time in the peak oil scene. I remember Kathy McMahon, the Peak Shrink, relating some feedback that she got, you know, from one of the people who followed her Peak Shrink blog. It was a man who was absolutely clamoring for collapse because it would put the feminists in their place. Now, I'm not saying that folks in First's Incel Maddox community, you know, have that exact mentality, but I definitely see and hear, or at least I think I see and hear reflections of it in the overlap between the doomer as nihilist or pessimist and the doomer who believes that industrial civilization is not long for this world. All right, and this next exchange, needs to be preceded by just the blanket statement, you know, the blanket sort of laying the groundwork. Nobody chooses when and where they are to be born, as far as we know. And, you know, when it comes to talking about the antipathy, you know, the hard feelings that exist between generations, particularly here in the United States, I mean, you know the word boomer is coming, right? Nobody chose to be a boomer, and no boomer really had the foresight to know, and there's no reason why we should expect that they would have had the foresight to understand how destructive, you know, their lifestyle and mentality would be to future generations down the line. And while, you know, if you want to, you can go online and you can find boomers saying the most absurd, self-aggrandizing garbage, really, you know, about how they deserve the vastly improved standard of living that they enjoyed, and that subsequent generations also deserve, you know, their relative poverty because of their failure to follow in the boomers' footsteps. Yeah, that's gross, but not all boomers believe that. So one boomer whose name I will withhold wrote to say that she really enjoyed the conversation with First and that she had some, you know, some sentiments that she would like me to pass on to him. She wrote, "I was moved by the episode Beyond Monogamy. I'm a baby boom female, 63 years old, a mom and long married. I am a feminist and have had a career, semi-retired now. But your conversation with First just about melted my heart. I felt so much empathy for him, and I learned about a situation I had never realized was going on. I lived in New York in the 80s, where the tables were turned and there were few men. That was painful, but not nearly as painful as what First describes. I guess that's because we didn't have the internet magnifying the very worst in us. Even though I'm a senior citizen, I still have kids of high school age. The program will enable me to be more helpful to my kids as they navigate all this. Many thanks for having the guts to face this issue. I watched First's documentary, and it was riveting. I hope you'll tell him that if you ever speak with him." So I forwarded that portion of the feedback to First, and he wrote back saying, "Hello, KMO. Thank you for sending me this. It's motivation to keep going with the project, as I've recently taken a break from it since it was getting mentally exhausting being in the black pill. Wow, I'm glad I was able to have our dialogue resonate with a boomer and a feminist. Responses like these restore some hope in discourse, since recently the red and blue tribes seem to not be able to have any agreement on any subject or even term, and it seems to only be accelerating to a very ugly collision. She reminds me of what my mother experienced during the Soviet collapse, a very distorted ratio in favor of males. Thanks again for having me on. This is why I'm a lifelong fan of the Sea Realm. It has opened many minds to many ideas. I'm glad the supporter will have her kids listen to the Sea Realm. In the statistical improbability that I have kids of my own, I'll make sure to introduce them to the show as well." I can't vouch for, you know, the very existence of the Sea Realm podcast by the time you have kids there, First, and I can't really say what I'll be talking about. In all likelihood, I will have rejected something that I currently hold dear. First concludes with P.S. Oh, he concludes with some stuff on a different topic. I've been thinking about buying a shotgun. I'll go ahead and read you his advice. P.S. Get a 12-gauge with a low-velocity birdshot for the home defense if you can. And then he recommends a particular YouTube channel to follow. And ends with a an invitation to come and join his gun culture peer group if I'm ever in his neck of the woods. Writing, "I'm part of a good group of firearms hobbyists here that can get you introduced to all the platforms, calibers, and best practices at a range. Thank you." All right. And so I suppose just a few comments on firearm purchases. Apparently, well, I just cut out several minutes of silence of me trying to find a piece of feedback that I received on the topic of firearms and buying a firearm and the surge in new purchases by first-time gun owners in the wake of, well, we'll just say recently, saying that it's in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests, uprising, whatever you want to call it. A lot of blue tribers who have been allergic to guns up to this point have changed their mind on that topic and decided to get strapped. And somebody wrote to me and said that they have a friend who runs a gun store, and the gun store friend said that most of these new purchases are young women. Often their father comes into the gun store with them and helps them pick out their first weapon, and usually it's a handgun. And I've had several people communicate with me saying that, you know, because there is such demand for purchasers right now, that supply and demand is all out of whack, that prices are high and availability is low. And, you know, I've been looking around, looking at just shotguns, mostly 12-gauge shotguns, pump action, because, you know, as much as I'd like a semi-automatic, I'm cheap and hope never to use the damn thing. So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of money on it. But from what I can tell, the prices of pump action shotguns in the, you know, 12 gauge range and the lower price range haven't really changed. And there's plenty of birdshot and buckshot to be had, at least here in New England. But the thing is, you know, Vermont is definitely, it's a very gun-friendly state. And most of the people who are from here, they already have weapons. You know, they're already armed. They're not rushing out to buy weapons, although, you know, some people might be expanding their arsenals. And also, the population density here is so low that there's, you know, we just don't have the necessary numbers for mass mania, even, you know, gun buying mania. We just don't have the population for it. So as far as I can tell, just from checking the online inventories of stores within driving distance, I could easily have a shotgun in hand later today if I decided that that's, you know, what's important to me. And I've mentioned, this all comes from a video that I put out a little while ago. And I think I mentioned in the video that the urge to, you know, make a firearms purchase is a cyclical thing. It's something that comes to me from time to time and isn't necessarily motivated by current events. It's just that, you know, for years, decades even, I was a strong supporter of the Libertarian Party platform. You know, not vaguely libertarian ideology in general, but specifically all the points enumerated in the Libertarian Party platform. And, you know, one of those is a strong support for the Second Amendment and the right to be armed. And, you know, while I've supported it in the abstract for decades, every now and again, it occurs to me, you know, you really should pony up at least a token amount and get armed and, you know, put your money where your mouth is to walk your talk. What, you know, insert your cliche here. And I just never have. But I often get to the window shopping phase. And, you know, window shopping being the window, which is my laptop screen or my phone screen. You know, I read articles on what's the best shotgun to get for the money. And, you know, the idea to get a shotgun rather than a handgun comes from my father, who, as you probably remember, was a Secret Service agent and knew quite a bit about firearms and home defense and gun maintenance and gun safety. And yeah, he said, if you're not going to be a gun aficionado, if you're not going to spend a lot of time at the range, if you're not going to, you know, take some fairly extensive educational training, you know, educational courses, really your shotgun is the best sort of versatile, low skill home defense option. And so that's what I think about. And here I am contemplating a firearm purchase. I don't know if it's because of current events, but, you know, I seem to have picked up on a ripple, a ripple in the web of people who, you know, previously not only weren't interested in guns, but probably took a pro-gun control attitude just because of their tribal affiliation. Now they're feeling insecure. And when we as Americans feel insecure, we look to make a purchase to alleviate our feelings of insecurity. It doesn't really do much to change the objective fact of, you know, how vulnerable we are, but the purchase itself makes us feel better for a little while. All right, so I'm not going to comment on any of the topics covered in the first three chapters, which is really the introduction and chapters 1 and 2 of the book by Donald J. Putin. But what you're about to hear was recorded and edited, processed with the intention of making it into an audiobook. So what I would value from you is some feedback just on the reading style, the cadence, how it sounds in terms of maybe sibilance or too much reverb or, you know, anything along those lines. And if, you know, sibilance and reverb are not in your vocabulary, don't worry about it. Just listen to see how it flows and make any suggestions that come to mind. All right. Thanks very much. I will talk to you again soon. And now here is the first part of the audiobook in progress, Donald J. Putin on American Exceptionalism. It's not you. It's just America being America. Welcome to American Exceptionalism. This book is not about Donald Trump. It is not about George W. Bush or Ronald Reagan or Bill or Hillary Clinton or any American leader in particular. It is about American exceptionalism. This is a loaded term. It means whatever the reader associates it with. Hence, the Fox News viewer might associate the term with God himself, decreeing that the white people of America have been specifically blessed to exercise their wasteful, greedy, racist, and greedy dominion over all his creation, and trash whatever they feel like, and crap on whomever they feel like, because America. People more grounded in reality might understand the term as a pejorative reference to the arrogant refusal of the United States to align itself with such universally recognized international cooperative efforts as the treaties pertaining to landmines, the rights of the child, and climate change, recently withdrawn from, or from its flouting of obligations, such as paying United Nations dues or upholding the Geneva Conventions, not torturing prisoners, for example, or, of course, for its undertaking of preventative war. As used here, I simply mean the term American exceptionalism literally. We will review how the United States is exceptional, as in an outlier from the rest of the world. In most cases, the United States is an outlier from its peers. Its peers are usually considered to be more developed countries of so-called first world, also understood as industrialized democracies. In a surprising number of cases, the U.S. is an outlier from virtually every other country on Earth. When I suggested that the United States is exceptional, I generally mean exceptionally bad. That is, the lives of the American people are more vulnerable, less happy, less satisfying, and simply not as good as people's lives in other countries. I suggest that this is the result of American exceptionalism itself. That the unique origins and history of the United States of America, first as a European colony and then as an independent nation, and then as a global empire, have resulted in this exceptional situation. This has serious implications. For the people unfortunate enough to be presently trapped within the United States, it means that they enjoy the world's highest incidence of anxiety disorders, the highest incidence of imprisonment, and being in a country that sports among the world's highest incidences of obesity, drug overdoses, and gun violence, and some rather dismal overall health and longevity outcomes. And this is despite the American people being by far the most profligate spenders on healthcare in the world. It means enjoying having the least paid vacations in the world, i.e. none, and being one of a tiny number of all countries without mandatory maternity leave and with draconian employment at will, i.e. significantly fewer rights for employees than other arrangements of employment with rights. To be sure, there are many other areas where the U.S. is most exceptional, and we will discuss many of them. So, you ask, dear reader, what can I do about this? I humbly suggest that almost no one has been able to improve the fundamentals of the American system in 400 years, and I ask you, what makes you arrogant enough to think that you can? Fortunately, there is an answer. At least, as I write this, in 2019, the United States will still give out passports to almost anyone capable of sitting still for a photograph, finding a birth certificate, filling out a form, and paying a fee. This is a good thing. Because it means that you can do the one thing that makes sense when dealing with an untenable situation. You can leave. I know, you may not be able to get work or immigrant authorization to move to the country of your choice. Most Americans insist that this be another first world country that speaks English. Of which there are five that I can think of. In order of distance, Canada, Ireland, the United Kingdom, New Zealand, and Australia. You may be trapped by loved ones who do not wish to leave themselves. Or your loved ones may simply not be up for travel, let alone immigration. I find myself in this situation. To you and to myself, I say, dip your toes in the water. Get out of the U.S. as often as you can, even if it is only to Canada or Mexico, and walk around, breathe the air, and talk to people. If you can learn the languages of the places you visit, all the better. Most people are delighted that you took the trouble to learn, even a little. Look at other people's faces and observe that they usually appear more relaxed than most Americans. They probably have not deferred health issues for years out of fear of personal financial destruction. They probably move around relatively freely, without fear of being sued or arbitrarily arrested or shaken down. They probably get mandatory vacation time from their jobs, which in turn probably pay them a living wage for their community. And they probably have a community. Ponder all of this in the context of what you read. Think about your own personal inadequacies, and ask yourself, how much they even have anything to do with you? Or is it just America being America? You may well choose to remain in the United States, even as it continues to slide to oblivion and desperately tries to take the rest of the planet with it. But then you will know that even thinking about reform or even the barest improvement of the American system is the most foolish of fool's errands. American exceptionalism simply precludes such improvement. It would violate every core American principle. And you are about to find out why. WTF? What's to follow? The organization of this entirely unambitious work begins with the Pledge of Allegiance in a typical American classroom, and then offers a brief history lesson of the origins of the United States, commencing with the white man's arrival in the 17th century. We discuss why this origin story is so important to understanding American exceptionalism. Hint: slavery. We move on to issues of childbirth and abortion policy. Then we return to school, move on to sports, entertainment, work, death, and taxes, and, in the longest chapter, the history of the American empire. Yes, it is an empire. We talk about issues of sex as pertaining to women, health care, guns, criminal justice, and mass incarceration. We proceed to discuss suburban life, poverty of spirit, faith-based initiatives, i.e., what passes for American religion, social immobility, yes, that's a thing, food, sex, debt, the legal system, and finally, we close out with the scariest area of American exceptionalism, the treatment of the natural environment. Some readers may believe that an accurate diagnosis is appropriate before treating the patient. I conclude that the patient is terminal, but do not let me stop you. I've tried to support my diagnosis with the data. Some of the data and some of my conclusions may be controversial. So be it. I'm trying to help here by pointing out some issues in a system that is beyond help. Assuming that what you read here rings true, you cannot say you were not warned. If it does not ring true to you, you probably were not going to read it anyway. At least we can have a good laugh about it. Chapter 1, and so it begins. The official public indoctrination of American children in their public schools, the one universally available public service in the United States that does not involve people carrying firearms, or does it? Commences at the beginning of each school day with a recitation of the aptly named Pledge of Allegiance. The pledge is actually codified into American law, found in Title IV United States Code, or USC Section 4. Quote, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America." Close quote. Let's get the young Americans used to worshiping stand-ins and not addressing actual reality. Indeed, best avoid reality. Even if that reality, a country or a political system or a geographic landmass or even a tribal grouping, is only itself symbolic of something else. Quote, "And to the republic for which it stands," close quote. We acknowledge that the American political system is not a democracy, as most people you might ask on the American streets would tell you, erroneously, thinking that Athenian self-governance is the American model. Yet, the American system is based on the centralized imperial Roman system, specifically its republican variant. The United States is, at best, a republic with democratic attributes. Quote, "One nation under God," close quote. To hell with the atheists. To hell with the non-believers in American greatness and exceptionalism, a group to which you, dear reader, will doubtless count yourself when you complete this, what I immodestly suggest will be a seminal exegesis on the subject of American exceptionalism. Your knowledge of the subject will be based in reality rather than upon propaganda. Uncritical acceptance of propaganda is something that Americans do better than anyone. A key part of the effectiveness of this propaganda results from telling Americans of their own personal inadequacy. From a young age, Americans are well-versed in acceptance of the products of the Dream Factory of Hollywood, the Lie Factory of Madison Avenue, the Dirty Tricks Factory of the CIA, and the Blunt Force Factory of the Pentagon. Quote, "indivisible," close quote. Americans evidently feel the need to spare school children from the results of recent elections or the unpleasantness of what passes for national discourse. This has been especially true since the United States outsourced its national discourse to an Australian maniac, who then hired a bunch of well-coiffed blonde Neanderthals to happy-talk fear and hate to angry and ignorant people. Quote, "with liberty and justice for all," close quote. This expression is somewhat hilarious for a nation that was largely built by slaves and that maintains a prison gulag archipelago that incarcerates almost 1% of its population at any given moment. Well over 2 million people in its prisons, jails, and detention centers, more than any other nation or empire, now or quite possibly ever. Thus begins the lesson, comrades. We start with the antecedent key point, the one major source of distinction of the American system from its European peers. As a historical matter, American white people did not go through feudalism. Whether or not Americans went through feudalism is a subject for some academic discussion in its own right, but I am focusing on white people, specifically the descendants of English people, who still form the critical mass of the American population. Non-white people, be they Native Americans or black people, Asian people or Latino people, generally have gone through some form of feudalism in the United States. This is particularly true if their forebearers were in the United States long enough. In many cases, many people of color may well be going through an unpleasant form of feudalism in the United States right now. This key difference, the lack of a feudal tradition for most of the American white people, who are still the majority of the American population, forms the backbone of American exceptionalism. The main consequence of American white people never going through feudalism is that the American system never established an embedded sense of reciprocal obligation. Thus, the powerful and the rich feel that they owe nothing to the powerless and the less well-off. Nothing. And indeed, not only is there no established legal or structural framework for such a reciprocal obligation, there's not even an honor system for this in the American context. Mutual obligation, however, is the essence of the structure of proper feudalism. Obligation, in the American system, however, is one way. This is entirely consistent with its most fundamental relationship, that of master and slave. A feudal lord, by contrast, knew that he was involved in an ongoing, complex relationship between his sublords, vassals, and his knights and peasants, all the way down to his serfs. All feudal parties would have understood that their relationships carried both rights and obligations. The lowliest serf knew that the lord could not just kick him and his family off the manor. Early industrialists, principally in Great Britain, strived to undo the various civil and religious obligations endemic in British economic life, through various structures that attached people to their land, even if only the right to live on and farm that land, pursuant to centuries of tradition and obligation. Ultimately, the industrialists, especially in Britain, were successful in managing to undo much of the feudal tradition. This, in turn, resulted directly in extraordinary human misery complete with poverty, disease, and penury, made most famous in the Dickensian and High Victorian context. Still, the British industrialists could not completely eradicate social obligation from the British Isles. Hence, the mother country eventually established a modern social democracy, complete with social welfare, including the popular National Health Service, free higher education, until recently, robust trade unions, until recently, strong worker protections, and so forth. At the same time, the United States remains exceptional in providing little or none of this. As a thought exercise, we could go back to the roots of the modern American state, which are barely 400 years old. At the dawn of white man's America in the 17th century, the upwardly mobile scum of English society decided to break out of their otherwise decaying feudal relationships and travel, often involuntarily as a result of criminal conviction, to the seemingly virgin territory of the New World. Once there, they could acquire land that was not subject to the intricacies of feudal obligation. In many cases, they could become absurdly rich in a matter of years instead of many generations. Of course, the Americas were not exactly virgin territory, so much as well-managed territory, the original permaculture, if you like. The caretaker native populations mostly, and very conveniently, succumbed to smallpox and other microbial infections, thus greatly reducing the trouble of having to slaughter any survivors in order to take their land. Where indigenous survivors proved intractable, the Europeans simply moved around them, or waited them out, and then slaughtered them. Native peoples proved rather difficult to negotiate with, to perform English-style wage or contract labor, needed to work back-breaking European-style cash-generating agricultural ventures. Hence, it was most fortunate that there was a ready supply of landless Europeans, as noted, quite a few of them who were convicted criminals, who gleefully accepted transportation in lieu of hanging. Of course, many of these Europeans came with issues. And, fortuitously, someone discovered, particularly in the mosquito-ridden southern parts of North America, that African peoples were pretty good at working in those conditions without dropping dead from malaria and other diseases quite as quickly as many of the Europeans. Of course, serving as a hard labor force thousands of miles from home was not exactly an arrangement that most reasonable people would seek out, which is why, for the most part, they were abducted, sold into slavery, and packed together as human sardines and sent on a transoceanic hell ride that killed untold thousands or millions of them before they even made it to the American side. Originally, Africans were dispatched to work in similar indenture contracts, as the Europeans and the colonies did not have laws permitting outright slavery for some decades after the arrival of Africans. But then the idea of a social pecking order with white indentured servants outranking black indentured servants took root. This quickly led to the development of American-style chattel slavery. This practice of divide and conquer on racial lines has been the model for American labor relations since the 1600s. Indeed, some form of divide and conquer has been the basis of virtually all American power relations ever since, whether between man and woman, enterprise and employee, police officer and member of the public, or between the state and the subject. Feel free to use the term citizen if you prefer to lie to yourself. Once human chattel slavery was established in North America, the associated human trafficking operation became an incredibly profitable business in its own right, as did agriculture, of course. Significant to our discussion of American exceptionalism, chattel slavery served as an excellent organizational model of the non-reciprocal, non-feudal arrangement that Americans still enjoy to this very day. This organizational chart should look familiar, as it has changed significantly little since the 1600s. The native peoples generally had no place on the hierarchy, other than as old tenants, with the unfortunate habit of not moving far enough away. The African slaves filled the role that otherwise would have been filled in Europe by serfs. Only the Africans had far fewer rights, eventually none, and were the recipients of affirmative disdain and stigma based on the invention of white supremacy, another American social invention duly perfected by the economic needs of the American elites. Next up were the European poor folk. This might be the most important group to discuss because they were then, and, at least in terms of their descendants, remain to this day by far the largest group in terms of sheer numbers within American society. They often originated in the peasant class, some might have been serfs, mostly farm people who might or might not have owned or controlled their own land. Nevertheless, at least on the European side of the Atlantic, they would have lived amidst a complex set of mutual obligations between state, nobles, and church, all of which were largely absent from the religiously tolerant New World that offered all of that free land. To be sure, there were vast economic opportunities resulting from the elimination of social obligation. These opportunities, coupled with the use of chattel slaves for further leverage, were enormous and entirely unparalleled in the Old World. For many new European arrivals, the myth of rugged individualism did not appear to be a myth. Whether they came intentionally or just to avoid being the main attraction at a public execution, they were giving up a complex and frequently oppressive set of obligations, as well as an established place in the world in exchange for the simple rules of the New World: profit or suffer, mightily. For school children, in presenting colonial life, much attention is focused upon the next group, the middle classes, of various skilled tradespeople that did not specifically work the land, at least full time. These people either brought their trades from the Old World or were fortunate enough to develop them in the Western Hemisphere. We focus on the middle classes, of course, to perpetuate the myth that the United States is a middle-class country. There were certainly profit opportunities for the middle classes in the Old World, although complicated guild arrangements and other social order factors, including taxation, could get in the way. Of course, this group usually had enough excess money and time and organizational skills to cause serious trouble to the top rungs of the social order if they were not happy. This is why many policies then and to this day exist for no purpose other than to keep the middle class happy, even if these policies are insanely expensive and inefficient. At the top of the social hierarchy sat the land barons. Some of them rose from the peasant class in Europe, and through hard work, luck, and ruthlessness, advancing from poverty in Europe to wealth in the New World, thus creating one of the most enduring myths of the United States: land of opportunity. To be sure, many, if not most, members of the land baron class were reasonably wealthy Europeans who crossed the Atlantic to become substantially wealthier, whether intending to return to the mother country with more money or to stay. Quite a few of these land barons actually brought noble titles with them. Many of them bought their titles with money made in the New World. The more skilled members of the middle classes were well aware that the entire social hierarchy game was rigged for the benefit of the land baron class, naturally, at the expense of everyone else. The peasants apparently were not so aware, or at least did not act as if they were aware. One reason that, to this very day, class consciousness has not developed in the U.S., a cornerstone of American exceptionalism. This curious result probably arose because poor Europeans received the twin entertainments of looking down on the dark-skinned chattel slaves and fantasizing about the myth of opportunity. As a result, the peasant class thought that the disposition provided by the New World hierarchy was the greatest thing ever. Notwithstanding that back in Europe, their feudal lords had very real obligations to them, such as seeing that food was available and that they didn't starve to death, obligations which were conveniently absent in the American context. I offer you this brief historical discussion because without it, most of what we will discuss about American exceptionalism will seem disjointed and nonsensical. Yet, comrades, it is neither disjointed nor nonsensical. It is, in fact, the most brilliantly designed social system ever constructed. Sadly, because active self-delusion is such an important component of it, it may quite possibly lead to the destruction of human life on planet Earth. This is because the vast bulk of Americans believe that a toxic, value-free existence fueled by the industrial and military might built up by their ancestors has provided them with the greatest country in the history of the universe. Part of this belief, despite all evidence to the contrary, is a belief that the U.S. is not an empire, because empires do bad things, and Americans only do good and nice things. So, away we go. Chapter 2. I Am Born. Or Am I? The famous first line of David Copperfield by Charles Dickens is appropriate to our discussion for a number of reasons, besides my personal admiration for Mr. Dickens as a writer. Dickens observed working conditions in Victorian England, to which American employers have always aspired. He observed endless work weeks, dark and unsafe factories, child labor, and low wages barely at subsistence levels. Ah, capitalism. Dickens also visited the United States in the mid-19th century and observed its singular obsession with money that has not changed significantly in nearly two centuries. We also start with I Am Born because we have to start somewhere. And what better way to start our cradle-to-grave discussion of American exceptionalism? Well, I have certainly already been born. I have a birth certificate to prove it. I strongly suspect that you have one, too. I intend to discuss some American baby being born somewhere to someone. As of the first two decades of the 21st century, approximately 2 in 5 American babies are not born with the benefit of clergy, i.e. to a married couple. This rate of birth outside of marriage, observe that old-school right-wingers prefer the pejorative term illegitimate, is probably not terribly different in Scandinavian countries or other countries that, unlike the United States, provide a vast array of social services. In those countries, an unmarried woman knows that she can expect to receive social services from her own government. Thus, she knows that she and her child will not fall into immediate penury, just because the father, who might even have adequate income and/or wealth to support them, might not be ready, willing, or able to marry and raise a child with her. Such social services are generally unavailable, or at least available only with painful strings attached in the United States, especially after President Bill Clinton signed a law, quote, ending welfare as we know it, close quote. Nonetheless, for a variety of reasons that probably exceed the scope of this already vast and ponderous work, I will limit my discussion of issues I am born in order to keep to the most salient points of American exceptionalism. We start with the difficult question of infant mortality. The United States, given the absurd amount of money that it spends on its healthcare system, is a disappointing, the correct term is dismal, 29th out of 29 in infant mortality among comparable OECD countries. On the overall chart of all countries, the United States is ranked somewhere in the high 30s worldwide, at least according to Wikipedia. Still, not very good. The United States is vast. People in more affluent parts of it, such as New York or the San Francisco Bay Area, are likely to have far better outcomes with respect to infant mortality and pretty much all other categories of healthcare outcomes compared to the less affluent states, such as large parts of the American South. Further, there is the statistical matter of how to count extreme premature births. These are births many weeks or months before expected term, which carry an extremely high mortality rate. The United States counts these as live births. A number of countries count such births as stillborn, and hence not part of their overall infant mortality statistics. This, however, only explains part of the overall measure and position of the U.S. What, you might ask, does cause the mighty U.S. and its healthcare spending juggernaut to have such exceptional, as in exceptionally bad, overall infant mortality? One possibility is maternal stress. The United States is proudly one of the 4 countries The other three being Papua New Guinea and the two landlocked South African enclaves of Swaziland and Lesotho that do not provide for any form of mandatory paid maternity leave for mothers. You, of course, recognize that the United States believes in rugged individualism. Hence, if women choose to have children, they can deal with the consequences on their own. These consequences include insanely high medical costs, loss of paid time from work in a country where 4 out of 5 adults live paycheck to paycheck, and some rather unpleasant health consequences to mothers themselves, as the U.S. also sports the worst maternal mortality rate in the developed world. For some perspective, if one is a member of the American ruling classes, such as corporate moguls, financiers, or land barons, or even from the middle classes, such as tradespeople and assorted credentialed professionals, there is a good chance that one's health outcomes will be well above typical American results. Perhaps they will even be on par with Europe, Japan, or other first-world countries that the United States pretends are its peers. For the rest, the mere middle class, the working class, and the actual poor, one's outcomes are less likely to be as favorable. Regardless of social class, the efficacy of medical care does not begin to address the monetary costs, which could well bankrupt a new mother or her entire family even before the child comes home from the hospital. But, you ask, what if the lady decides to say "niet" to an unwanted pregnancy? As I write this, in the year 2019, the United States had had legally available abortion as a legal right since 1973. That year, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a famous decision called Roe v. Wade, 410 U.S. 113, 1973. Nevertheless, in the first few months of 2019, a number of states passed draconian anti-abortion laws, anticipating that a now favorable Supreme Court, featuring Justice Brett Kavanaugh, himself accused of attempted rape of a young woman, would find such laws constitutional, or at least find an excuse to overturn Roe and recriminalize abortion in much of the U.S. In practical terms, the government-sponsored medical care usually made available to poor people may not cover abortion procedures in many places in the United States. Indeed, while forcing a woman to carry an unwanted child to term seems draconian in any society, the often quite violent busybodies who concern themselves with whether other people can undergo a single medical procedure could not give the slightest care to the American big picture. They do not care that their beloved exceptional country fails to provide for paid maternity leave, for paid or even remotely affordable child care, or even for adequate assurance of food and shelter to young children or new mothers. Rugged individualism as practiced in the U.S. is good and hard. Indeed, the same busybodies who protest this single medical procedure, conveniently obtained only by women, but who never protest any men's issues, such as psychotic gun culture, because America, frequently turn violent. Said protesters have shown a willingness to maim and kill to show just how pro-life they really are. The irony is that abortion opponents have essentially won, even before the day Roe v. Wade is overturned by a controversial Supreme Court majority, which would require the votes of accused attempted rapist Brett Kavanaugh and alleged sexual harasser Clarence Thomas. Abortion is presently unobtainable in something like 87% of the counties in the United States, simply because there is no facility in those locations in which abortion may be performed. If one has taken the trouble to get pregnant, then carry the child to term, she will eventually give birth to a child either blessed or cursed with his or her parents' social and economic status, with little chance of escape. This is because the United States has become one of the world's most unequal nations in terms of distribution of wealth. And in terms of social mobility, at least with respect to the extent that these things can be measured, Americans do not appear to have much of it anymore. That poor women, or even middle-class women, might believe that they are not good candidates to raise a child and thus might choose to abort their pregnancy is, however, the absolute biggest insult to American capitalism possible. Women who exercise reproductive freedom in this way would be voting with their uterus to hold back potential cannon fodder for the American military empire or for its industrial machine, or perhaps potential slave labor in the prison industrial complex. Indeed, because of legalized abortion, tens of millions of unwanted children have simply not been born. It is hardly a coincidence that abortion is such a staple of the so-called Republican Party, which is usually also thought of as the more pro-business and, if you like, pro-freedom of the two right-wing parties in the American political duopoly, and of course the more right-wing one. While the American media pitches the culture wars as separate from lunch bucket economic policies, this is, of course, nonsense, delusion being an indispensable element of American exceptionalism. Now, back to our story. The young lad or lass is born into their usually maternal parents' circumstances. To a shocking degree, in the allegedly richest and most powerful country on earth, this means immediate penury. It often includes food insecurity. An estimated 1 in 8 Americans suffer from food insecurity, defined by the United States Department of Agriculture as a lack of consistent access to enough food for an active, healthy life, including an estimated 12 million children, as of 2017. This takes place despite complicated and expensive government programs at all levels of American government intended to address it. Other issues facing an unfortunately large number of children and their families, especially working families, include housing insecurity and healthcare insecurity. For good measure, filial relationships may be abruptly interrupted based on the real or imagined behavior of their parents that could result in one or both parents being abruptly carted off to serve in the prison industrial complex. Around 1 in 3 black men receives this opportunity. Much of this arises from the war on drugs. That is very good at both being a war, in terms of violence brought to bear on communities, particularly communities of color, and at raging seemingly forever, without any possible end in sight. Of course, even without as dramatic a development as having one or both parents shunted to the penal system, the parents may have their employment and hence their health care and housing interrupted for an infinite number of reasons. This is because the U.S. is notoriously dreadful by world standards in protecting workers or in providing them with meaningful benefits. Even households of the middle and upper middle classes often require both parents to work outside the house just to afford housing, especially in some of the nation's most desirable metropolitan areas. And childcare must be arranged, often at large expense. As long as there is still some income beyond childcare, the two-earner household is required to maintain the arrangement, particularly on the East and West coasts. And so the young lad or lass of middle or upper middle class will often find themselves raised not by mom or even by daddy or papa or granny or pops, but by a paid stranger. In many cases, there may be an institution, often a daycare center, involved. There, as suggested by blogger and author Dmitry Orlov, American youth will develop all the skills necessary to become a model prisoner of war. Assuming that said young lad or lass has successfully completed potty training, they are ready to begin the first of their many official encounters with the American state, the public school. Unless, of course, their parents are affluent, or just plain lucky enough to be able to send them to a non-state arrangement for their education, or are old school, or if you prefer, reactionary enough, to demand to school their children at home. It is time for school. All right, that is all for this episode of the Sea Realm Vault podcast. Thank you, as always, for subscribing. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.